We're not metaphors. I know, I say, but metaphors help eliminate what separates you and me. A faint smile comes to her as she looks up at me. That's the oddest pickup line I've ever heard. There are a lot of odd things going on, but I feel like I'm slowly getting closer to the truth. Actually getting closer to a metaphorical truth, or metaphorically getting closer to an actual truth. Or maybe they supplement each other. Either way, I don't think I can stand the sadness I feel right now, I tell her. I feel the same way. So you did come back to this town to die. She shakes her head. To be honest about it, I'm not trying to die. I'm just waiting for death to come. Like sitting on a bench at the station, waiting for the train. And do you know when the train's going to arrive? She takes her hand away from mine and touches her eyelids with the tips of her fingers. Kafka, I've worn away so much of my own life, worn myself away. At a certain point, I should have stopped living, but didn't. I knew that life was pointless, but I couldn't give up on it. So, I ended up just marking time, wasting my life in vain pursuits. I wound up hurting myself, and that made me hurt others around me. That's why I'm being punished now, why I'm under a kind of curse. I had something too complete, too perfect once, and afterwards, all I could do was despise myself. That's the curse I can never escape. So I'm not afraid of death. And to answer your question, yes. I have a pretty good idea of when the time is coming. Once more I take her hand in mine. The scales are shaking, and just a tiny weight would send them tipping to one side or the other. I have to think. I have to decide. I have to take a step forward. Miss Saiki, would you sleep with me? I ask. You mean even if I were your mother, in that theory of yours? It's as though everything around me is in flux, as though it all has a double meaning. She ponders this. That might not be true for me, though. For me, things might not be so nuanced. It might be more like all or nothing. And you know which it is? She nods. Do you mind if I ask you a question? About what? Where did you come up with those two chords? Chords? The ones in the bridge in Kafka on the Shore. She looks at me. You like them? I nod. I found those chords in an old room very far away. The door to the room was open then, she says softly. A room that was far, far away. She closes her eyes and sinks back into memories. Kafka, close the door behind you, she says. And that's exactly what I do. After we close the library for the night, Oshima drives me to a seafood restaurant a little way away. Through a large window in the restaurant, we can see the night sea, and I think about all the creatures living under the water. Sometimes you've got to get out and eat some decent food, he tells me. Relax. I don't think the police have staked the place out. We both needed a change of scenery. We eat a huge salad and split an order of paella. I'd love to go to Spain someday, Oshima says. Why Spain? To fight in the Spanish Civil War. But that ended a long time ago. I know that. Lorca died, and Hemingway survived, Oshima says. But I still have the right to go to Spain and be a part of the Spanish Civil War. Metaphorically. Exactly, he says, giving me a wry look. A haemophiliac of undetermined sex who's hardly ever set foot outside Shikoku isn't about to actually go off to fight in Spain, I would think. We attack the mound of paella, washing it down with Perrier. Have there been any developments in my father's case? I ask. Nothing to report, really. Except for a typical smug memorial piece in the arts section. There hasn't been much in the papers. The investigation must be stuck. The sad fact is the arrest rate's been going down steadily these days, just like the stock market. I mean, the police can't even track down the son who's disappeared. The 15-year-old youth. 15, with a history of violent behaviour, Oshima adds. The obsessed young runaway. How about that incident with things falling from the sky? Oshima shakes his head. They're taking a break on that one. Nothing else weird has fallen from the sky, unless you count that award-winning lightning we had 2 days ago. So things have settled down. It seems like it. Or maybe we're just in the eye of the storm. I nod, pick up a clam, pluck the meat out with a fork, then put the shell on a plate full of empty shells. Are you still in love? Oshima asks me. How about you? I say. Am I in love, do you mean? I nod. In other words, you're daring to get personal and ask about the antisocial romance that colours my warped, homosexual, gender identity disordered life. I nod, and he follows suit. I have a partner, yes, he admits. He makes a serious face and eats a clam. It's not the kind of passionate, stormy love you find in a Puccini opera or anything. We keep a careful distance from each other. We don't get together that often, but we do understand each other at a deep, basic level. Understand each other. Whenever Haydn composed, he always made sure to dress formally, even to the point of wearing a powdered wig. I look at him in surprise. What's Haydn got to do with anything? He couldn't compose well unless he did that. How come? I have no idea. That's between Haydn and his wig. Nobody else would understand. Inexplicable, I imagine. Tell me, when you're alone, do you sometimes think about your partner and feel sad? Of course, he says. It happens sometimes. When the moon turns blue, when birds fly south, when... Why, of course? I ask. Anyone who falls in love is searching for the missing pieces of themselves. So anyone who's in love gets sad when they think of their lover. It's like stepping back inside a room you have fond memories of. One you haven't seen in a long time. It's only a natural feeling. You're not the person who discovered that feeling, so don't go trying to patent it, okay? I put down my fork and look up. A fond, old, faraway room. Precisely, Oshima says. He holds his fork straight up for emphasis. Just a metaphor, of course. Miss Saiki comes to my room after 9 that night. I'm sitting at the desk reading a book when I hear her Golf pull into the car park. The door slams shut. Rubber-soled shoes crunch slowly across the gravel. And finally there's a knock at my door. I open the door, and there she is. This time, she's wide awake. She has on a pinstriped silk blouse, thin blue jeans, white deck shoes. I've never seen her in trousers before. I haven't seen this room in a long time, she says. She stands by the wall and looks at the painting. Or this picture, either. Is the place in the painting around here, I ask. Do you like it? I nod. Who painted it? A young artist who boarded that summer at the Comoros, she says. He wasn't very famous, at least at the time. I've forgotten his name. He was a very friendly person, though, and I think he did a good job with the painting. There's something, I don't know, powerful about it. I sat beside him the whole time and watched him work. I made all kinds of half-joking suggestions as he painted. We got along well. It was the summer a long time ago. I was 12. The boy in the painting was 12 too. It looks like the sea around here. Let's go for a walk, she says. I'll take you there. I walk with her to the shore. We cut through a pine forest and walk down the sandy beach. The clouds are breaking up, and a half moon shines down on the waves. Small waves that scarcely reach the shore, hardly break. She sits down at a spot on the sand, and I sit next to her. The sand's still faintly warm. As if she's checking the angle, she points to a place on the shoreline. It was right over there, she says. He painted that place from here. He put the deck chair over there, had the boy pose in it, and set up his easel right around here. I remember it well. Can you see how the position of the island is the same as in the painting? I follow where she's pointing, and sure enough it's the same. No matter how long I gaze at it, though, it doesn't look like the place in the painting. I tell her that. It's changed completely, Miss Saiki replies. That was 40 years ago, after all. Things change. A lot of things affect the shoreline. Waves, wind, typhoons. Sand gets washed away. They bring more by the lorry load. But this is definitely the place. I remember what occurred there very well. That was the summer I had my first period, too. We sit there, looking at the scenery. The clouds shift, and the moonlight dapples the sea. Wind blows through the pine forest, sounding like a crowd of people all sweeping the ground at the same time. I scoop up some sand and let it spill out between my fingers. It falls to the beach and, like lost time, becomes part of what's already there. I do this over and over. What are you thinking about? Miss Saiki asks me. About going to Spain, I reply. What are you going to do there? Eat some delicious paella. That's all. And fight in the Spanish Civil War. That ended more than 60 years ago. I know, I tell her. Lorca died, and Hemingway survived. But you want to be a part of it? I nod. Yep. Blow up bridges and stuff. And fall in love with Ingrid Bergman. But in reality, I'm here in Takamatsu, and I'm in love with you. That's your tough luck. I put my arm around her. You put your arm around her. She leans against you, and a long interval of time passes. Did you know that I did this self-same thing a long time ago, right in this same place? I know, you tell her. How do you know that? Miss Saiki asks, and looks into your eyes. I was there then. Blowing up bridges. Yes, I was there, blowing up bridges. Metaphorically. Of course. You hold her in your arms, draw her close, kiss her. You can feel the strength deserting her body. We're all dreaming, aren't we? She says. All of us are dreaming. Why did you have to die? I couldn't help it, you reply. Together you walk along the beach back to the library. You turn off the light in your room, draw the curtains, and without another word, climb into bed and make love. Pretty much the same sort of lovemaking as the night before. With two differences, though. After sex, she starts to cry. That's one. She buries her face in the pillow, and silently she weeps. You don't know what to do. You gently lay a hand on her naked shoulder. You know you should say something, but don't have any idea what. Words have all died in the hollow of time, piling up soundlessly at the dark bottom of a volcanic lake. And this time, as she leaves, you can hear the engine of her car. That's number two. She starts the engine, turns it off for a time, as if she's thinking about something, then turns the key again and drives out of the car park. That blank, silent interval between leaves you sad, so terribly sad. Like fog from the sea, that blankness wends its way into your heart and remains there for a long, long time. Finally, it's a part of you. She leaves behind her a damp pillow wet with her tears. You touch the warmth with your hand and watch the sky outside gradually lighten. Far away, a crow caws. The earth slowly keeps on turning. But beyond any of those details of the real, there are dreams. And everyone's living in them.
32. When Nakata woke up at 5 a.m., he saw the huge stone right next to his pillow. Hoshino was still sound asleep in the futon next to his, mouth half open, hair sticking every which way, Chunichi Dragon's cap tossed on the bed beside him. His sleeping face had a determined, no matter what, don't dare wake me up look to it. Nakata wasn't particularly surprised to find the stone there. His mind adapted immediately to the new reality, accepted it, didn't question how it came to be there. Working out cause and effect was never his strong suit. He sat down formally beside his bed, legs tucked neatly under him, and spent some quality time with the stone, staring intently at it. Then he reached out and, as if he were stroking a large, sleeping cat, touched it. At first gingerly, with only his fingertips, and when that seemed safe, he ran his hand carefully over the whole surface. And while he caressed it, he was thinking, or at least had the pensive look of someone thinking. As if he were reading a map, he ran his hand over every part of the stone, memorizing every bump and cranny, getting a solid sense of it. Then he suddenly reached up and rubbed his short hair, searching, perhaps, for the correlation between the stone and his own head. At length he gave what might have been a sigh, stood up, opened the window, and stuck his face out. All that was visible was the rear of the building next door, a shabby, miserable sort of building, the kind where shabby people spent one shabby day after another doing their shabby work, the kind of fallen-from-grace sort of building you find in any city, the kind which Charles Dickens could spend 10 pages describing. The clouds floating above the building were like hard clumps of dirt from a vacuum cleaner no one ever cleaned. Or maybe more like all the contradictions of the Third Industrial Revolution condensed and set to float in the sky. Regardless, it was going to rain soon. Nakata looked down and spied a skinny black cat, tail alert, patrolling the top of a narrow wall between the two buildings. "There's going to be lightning today," he called. But the cat didn't appear to hear him, didn't even turn round, just continued its languid patrol and disappeared in the shadows of the building. Nakata set off down the hall, plastic bag with wash bag inside in hand, to the communal sinks. He washed his face, brushed his teeth, and shaved with a safety razor. Each operation took time. He carefully washed his face, taking his time, carefully brushed his teeth, taking his time, carefully shaved, taking his time. He trimmed his nose hairs with a pair of scissors, straightened up his eyebrows, cleaned out his ears. He was the type who took his time no matter what he did, but this morning he took everything at an even slower pace than usual. No one else was up washing his face at this early hour, and it was still a while before breakfast would be ready. Hoshino didn't look like he'd be getting up any time soon. With the whole place to himself, Nakata looked in the mirror, leisurely preparing for the day, and pictured the faces of all the cats he'd seen in the book in the library 2 days before. Unable to read, he didn't know the names of the cats depicted, but a clear picture of each and every cat's face was etched in his memory. "There really are a lot of cats in the world, that's for sure," he said, as he cleaned out his ears with a cotton bud. His first ever visit to a library had made him painfully aware of how little he knew. The amount of things he didn't know about the world was infinite. The infinite, by definition, has no limits, and thinking about that gave him a mild migraine. He gave up and turned his thoughts back to cats of the world. How nice it would be, he thought, to be able to talk with each and every cat in there. There must be all kinds of cats in the world, all with different ways of thinking and talking. Would foreign cats speak in foreign languages? He wondered. But this was another difficult subject, and again his head began to throb. After his ablutions, he went to the toilet and took care of business as usual. This didn't take as long as his other ablutions. Finished, he took his plastic bag with wash bag inside back to the room. Oshino was sound asleep, exactly as he'd left him. Nakata picked up the discarded Aloha shirt and jeans, folding them up neatly. He set them down on top of each other, next to Hoshino's futon, adding the Chunichi Dragon's baseball cap on top, like a summary title given to a motley collection of ideas. He took off his yukata robe and put on his usual trousers and shirt, then rubbed his hands together and took a deep breath. He sat down again in front of the stone, staring at it for a while before hesitantly reaching out to touch it. "There's going to be thunder today," he pronounced, to no one in particular. He may have been addressing the stone. He punctuated this with a couple of nods. Nakata was by the window, running through an exercise routine, when Hoshino finally woke up. Humming the radio exercise music to himself, Nakata moved in time to the tune. Hoshino squinted at his watch. It was just after 8. He craned his neck to make sure the stone was where he'd put it. In the light, the stone looked much bigger and rougher than he'd remembered it. "So I wasn't dreaming after all," he said. "I'm sorry, what did you say?" Nakata asked. "The stone," Hoshino said. "The stone's right there. It wasn't a dream." "We have the stone," Nakata said simply, still in the midst of his exercises, making it sound like some central proposition of 19th-century German philosophy. "It's a long story, though, Gramps, about how the stone got to be there." "Yes, Nakata thought that might be the case." "Anyway," Hoshino said, sitting up in bed and sighing deeply, "it doesn't matter. The important thing is it's here. To cut a long story short." "We have the stone," Nakata repeated. "That's what matters." Hoshino was about to respond, but suddenly noticed how famished he was. "Hey, what you say we grab some breakfast?" "Nakata's quite hungry." After breakfast, as he was drinking tea, Hoshino said, "So what are you going to do with the stone?" "What should Nakata do with it?" "Give me a break," Hoshino said, shaking his head. "You said you had to find that stone, so that's why I managed to come up with it last night. Don't hit me now with this gee whiz, what should I do with it stuff. Okay?" "Yes, you are right. To tell you the truth, though, I don't know yet what I'm supposed to do with it. That presents a problem." "A problem indeed," Nakata replied, though you'd never know it from his expression. "So if you spend some time thinking about it, you'll work out what to do?" "I think so. It takes Nakata much longer to do things than other people."
"Okay, but listen here, Mr. Nakata."
"Yes, Mr. Hoshino.
I don't know who gave it that name, but since it's called the Entrance Stone, I'm guessing it has to have been the entrance to something a long time ago, don't you think? There must be some legend or explanation about it."
"Yes, that must be the case.
But you have no idea what kind of entrance we're talking about here?"
"No, not yet. I used to talk to cats all the time, but I've never spoken to a stone. Doesn't sound like it'd be too easy. It's very different from talking to a cat."
"But still, pinching that stone from a shrine, you sure we won't be cursed or something? That's really bothering me. Taking it's one thing, but dealing with it now that we have it could be a total pain in the butt. Colonel Sanders told me there wouldn't be any curse, but I can't totally trust the guy, you know what I mean? Colonel Sanders? Oh, there's an old guy by that name. The guy on the Kentucky Fried Chicken ads, with the white suit, beard, stupid glasses. You don't know who I mean? I'm very sorry, but I don't believe I know that person. You don't know Kentucky Fried Chicken? Well, that's kind of unusual. Well, whatever. The old guy's an abstract concept, anyway. He's not human, not a god or a Buddha. He doesn't have any shape, but he has to take on some sort of appearance, so he just happened to choose the colonel. Nakata looked perplexed and rubbed his salt and pepper hair. I don't understand. Well, to tell you the truth, I don't either, though I'm the one spouting off, Hoshino said. Anyhow, this weird old guy suddenly pops up out of nowhere and rattles off all those things to me. Long story short, the old guy helped me out so I could locate the stone, and I lugged it back here. I'm not trying to win your sympathy or anything, but it was a long, hard night, I can tell you. What I'd really like to do right now is hand the whole thing over to you and let you take over. I will. That was quick. Mr. Hoshino, Nakata said. What? There's going to be a lot of thunder soon. Let's wait for that. You're telling me the thunder's going to do something to help with the stone? I don't know for sure, but I'm starting to get that feeling. Thunder, eh? Sounds kind of cool. Okay, we'll wait and see what happens.
When they got back to their room, Hoshino flopped face down on the futon and switched on the TV. Nothing was on except a variety of shows targeted at housewives, but since there was no other way of killing time, he kept watching, giving a running critique of everything on the screen. Nakata, meanwhile, sat in front of the stone, gazing at it, rubbing it, occasionally mumbling. Hoshino couldn't catch what he was saying. For all he knew, the old man might actually be talking to the stone. After a couple of hours, Hoshino ran out to a nearby convenience store and came back with a bag full of milk and sweet rolls, which the two of them had for lunch. While they were eating, the maid showed up to clean the room, but Hoshino told her not to bother, they were fine.
"You're not going out anywhere?"
she asked. "Nope," he answered. "We've got something to do here."
"Because there's going to be thunder," Nakata added.
"Thunder, I see,"
the maid said dubiously before she left, looking like she'd rather not have anything more to do with this weird pair. Around midday, thunder rumbled dully off in the distance, and, as if waiting for a signal, it started sprinkling. Unimpressive thunder, a lazy dwarf trampling on a drum. Before long, though, the raindrops grew larger, and it was soon a regular downpour, wrapping the world in a wet, stuffy smell. Once the thunder started, the two sat down across from each other, the stone between them, like Indians passing a peace pipe. Nakata was still mumbling to himself, rubbing the stone or his head. Hoshino puffed on a Marlboro and watched.
"Mr. Hoshino," Nakata said,
"what's up?"
"Would you stay with me for a while?"
"Sure. I'm not going anywhere in this rain."
"There's a chance something strange might happen."
"Are you kidding me?" Hoshino began. "Everything's been strange enough already."
"Mr. Hoshino?"
"Yeah?"
"All of a sudden I was wondering, what am I anyway? What is Nakata?"
Hoshino pondered this.
"That's a tough one. A little off the wall. I mean, I don't even know what I am, so I'm not the guy to ask. Thinking isn't exactly my thing, you know? But I know you're an okay, honest guy. You're out of kilter big time, but you're somebody I trust. That's why I came with you all the way to Shikoku. I may not be so bright either, but I do have an eye for people."
"Mr. Hoshino?"
"Yeah."
"It's not just that I'm dumb. Nakata's empty inside. I finally understand that. Nakata's like a library without a single book. It wasn't always like that. I used to have books inside me. For a long time I couldn't remember, but now I can. I used to be normal, just like everybody else. But something happened, and I ended up like a container with nothing inside." Yeah, but if you look at it like that, we're all pretty much empty, don't you think? You eat, take a dump, do your crummy job to get your lousy pay and get laid occasionally, if you're lucky. What else is there? Still, you know, interesting things do happen in life. Like with us now. I'm not sure why. My grandpa used to say that things never work out like you think they will, but that's what makes life interesting, and that makes sense. If the Chunichi Dragons won every single game, who'd ever watch baseball?
You liked your grandfather a lot, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. If it hadn't been for him, I don't know what would have happened to me. He made me feel like I should try and make something of myself. He made me feel, I don't know, connected. That's why I quit the motorcycle gang and joined the self-defense force. Before I knew it, I wasn't getting into trouble anymore.
But you know, Mr. Hoshino, Nakata doesn't have anybody. Nothing. I'm not connected at all. I can't read, and my shadow's only half of what it should be.
Everybody has their shortcomings.
Mr. Hoshino?
Yeah.
If I'd been my normal self, I think I would have lived a very different kind of life. Like my two younger brothers, I would have gone to college, worked in a company, got married and had a family, driven a big car, played golf on my days off. But I wasn't normal, so that's why I'm the Nakata I am today. It's too late to start again. I understand that. But still, even for a short time, I'd like to be a normal Nakata. Up until now, there was never anything in particular I wanted to do. I always did what people told me as best I could. Maybe that just became a habit. But now I want to go back to being normal. I want to be a Nakata with his own ideas, his own meaning.
Hoshino sighed. If that's what you want, then go for it. Not that I have a clue what a normal Nakata's like.
Nakata doesn't either.
I just hope it works out. I'll be praying for you, that you can be normal again.
Before I get back to being normal, though, there are some things I have to take care of.
Such as?
Such as Johnny Walker.
Johnny Walker? Hoshino said. Yeah, you mentioned that before. You mean the whiskey guy?
Yes. I went to the police right away and told them about him. I knew I had to report to the governor, but they wouldn't listen. So I have to find a solution on my own. I have to take care of that before I can become a normal Nakata again, if that's possible.
I don't really get it, but I guess you're saying you need this stone to do whatever it is you need to do.
That's right. I have to get the other half of my shadow back.
By this time the thunder was deafening. Lightning zigzagged across the sky, followed a moment later by a great clap of thunder. The air shook and the loose window panes rattled nervously. Dark clouds capped the whole sky, and it got so dark inside that they could scarcely make out each other's faces. They left the light off, however. They were still sitting as before, with the stone between them. The rain was lashing down so hard it felt suffocating just to look at it. Every flash of lightning lit up the room for an instant. They didn't say anything for a while.
Okay, but why do you have to have anything to do with this stone, Mr. Nakata? Hoshino asked when the thunder had died down a bit. Why does it have to be you?
Because I'm the one who's gone in and come out again.
I don't follow you.
I left here once and came back again. It happened when Japan was in a big war. The lid came off and I left here. By chance I came back. That's why I'm not normal and my shadow's only half of what it was. But then I can talk to cats, though I can't do it well any more. I can also make things fall from the sky.
Like those leeches?
Yes. A unique talent, that's for sure. That's right. Not everybody can do it.
And that's because you went out and came back again. I guess you really are pretty extraordinary.
After I came back, I wasn't normal anymore. I couldn't read,
and I've never touched a woman.
That's hard to believe.
Mr. Hoshino?
Yeah?
I'm scared. As I told you, I'm completely empty. Do you know what it means to be completely empty?
Hoshino shook his head. I guess not.
Being empty is like an unlived-in house. An unlocked, unlived-in house. Anybody can come in any time they want. That's what scares me the most. I can make things rain from the sky, but most of the time I don't have any idea what I'm going to make rain next. If it were 10,000 knives, or a huge bomb, or poison gas, I don't know what I'd do. I could say I'm sorry to everybody, but that wouldn't be enough.
You're right, Hoshino said. Just apologizing wouldn't do it. Leeches are bad enough, but those things are even worse.
Johnny Walker went inside Nakata. He made me do things I didn't want to. Johnny Walker used me, but I didn't have the strength to fight it. Because I don't have anything inside me.
Which explains why you want to go back to being a normal Nakata, one with substance.
That's exactly right. I'm not very bright, but I could build furniture, and I did it day after day. I enjoyed making things. Desks, chairs, chests. It's nice to make things with nice shapes. Those years I made furniture, I never thought about wanting to be normal again. And there wasn't anyone I knew who tried to get inside me. Nakata never felt afraid of anything. But after meeting Johnny Walker, I got very afraid.
So what did this Johnny Walker make you do after he got inside you?
A loud rumble ripped through the sky, and the lightning was close by the sound of it. Hoshino's eardrums were stinging from the roar.
Nakata inclined his head to one side, listening intently, slowly rubbing the surface of the stone all the while.
He made me shed blood.
Blood?
Yes, but it didn't stick to Nakata's hands.
Hoshino pondered this for a while, puzzled.
Anyway, once you open the entrance stone, all sorts of things will naturally settle back where they're meant to be, right? Like water flowing from high places to low places?
Nakata considered this. It might not be that simple. Nakata's job is to find the entrance stone and open it. What happens after that, I'm afraid I don't know.
Okay, but why is the stone in Shikoku?
The stone is everywhere, not just in Shikoku, and it doesn't have to be a stone.
I don't get it. If it's everywhere, then couldn't you have done all this at home in Nakano? That would have saved a lot of time and effort.
Nakata rubbed a palm over his close-cropped hair.
That's a hard question. I've been listening to the stone for a while now, but can't understand it all that well yet. But I do think both of us had to come here. We had to cross a big bridge. It wouldn't have worked in Nakano Ward.
Can I ask you something else?
Yes?
If you do open the entrance stone here, is something amazing going to happen? Like, is what's-his-name, that genie, going to pop out like in Aladdin? Or will a prince that's been turned into a frog French kiss me? Or else will we be eaten alive by Martians?
Something might happen. But then again, maybe nothing. I haven't opened it yet, so I don't know. You can't know until you open it.
But it might be dangerous, huh?
Yes, exactly.
Jesus.
Hoshino took a Marlboro from his pocket and lit it.
My grandpa used to always tell me that my bad point was running off with people I didn't know without thinking what I was doing. I guess I must have always done that. The child's the father of the man, like they say. Anyhow, there's nothing I can do about it now. I've come all this way and gone to all the trouble of locating the stone, so I can't just head on home without seeing it through. We know it might be dangerous, but what the hell? Why don't we open it up and see what happens? At least it'll make a great story for the grandchildren.
Nakata has a favor to ask you, Mr. Hoshino.
What's that?
Could you pick up the stone?
No problem.
It's a lot heavier than when you carried it here.
I know I'm no Schwarzenegger, but I'm stronger than I look. In the SDF I came second in our unit's arm wrestling contest. Plus you've cured my back problems, so I can give it everything I've got.
Hoshino stood up, grasped the stone in both hands, and tried to lift it. The stone didn't budge an inch.
You're right, it is a lot heavier, he said, gasping. A while ago, lifting it up was no problem. Now it feels as if it's nailed to the floor.
It's the valuable entrance stone, so it can't be easily moved. If it could, that would be a problem.
I suppose so.
Then a few irregular flashes of lightning ripped through the sky, and a series of thunderclaps shook the earth to its core. It was as if somebody just opened the lid to hell, Hoshino thought. One final clap of thunder boomed nearby, and suddenly there was a thick, suffocating silence. The air was damp and stagnant, with a hint of something suspicious, as if countless ears were floating in the air, waiting to pick up a trace of some conspiracy. The two men were frozen, wrapped in the midday darkness. And then the wind picked up again, lashing rain against the window. Thunder rumbled, but not as violently as before. The center of the storm had passed the city. Hoshino looked up and swept the room with his eyes. Everything seemed strangely cold and distant, the four walls even more blank than before. The Marlboro butt in the ashtray had turned to ash. He swallowed and brushed the silence from his ears.
Hey, Mr. Nakata.
What is it, Mr. Hoshino?
I feel as though I'm having a bad dream.
Well, at least we're having the same dream.
You're right, Hoshino said, and scratched his earlobe in resignation. Right you are. Bright as rain. Rain, rain, go away, come again some other day. Anyway, that makes me feel better.
He then stood up once more to try to move the stone. He took a deep breath, grabbed it, and focused all his strength in his hands. With a low grunt, he managed to lift the stone an inch or two.
You moved it a little, Nakata said. So we know it's not nailed down, but I've got to move it more than that, I guess. You need to flip it right over.
Like a pancake.
Nakata nodded.
That's right. Right. Pancakes are one of Nakata's favorites.
Glad to hear it. So they have pancakes in hell, huh? Anyway, let me give it one more try. I think I can flip this thing over.
Hoshino closed his eyes and summoned up every ounce of strength, concentrating it on this one action.
This is it, he told himself. Now or never.
He got a good grip, carefully tightened it, then took a huge breath, let out a gut-wrenching yell, and all at once lifted the stone, holding it in the air at a 45-degree angle. That was the limit of his strength. Somehow he was able to hold it in that position. He gasped, his whole body aching, his bones and muscles and nerves screaming in pain, but he wasn't about to give up. He took in one last deep breath and gave out a battle cry, but couldn't hear his own voice. He had no idea what he was saying. Eyes shut tight, he managed to drag out a strength he never knew he had, strength that should have been beyond him. Lack of oxygen made everything go white. One after another, his nerves snapped like popping fuses. He couldn't see or hear a thing, or even think. There wasn't enough air. Still, he inched the stone upward and, with a final cry, tipped it over. He lost his grip, and the weight of the stone itself flipped it over. A massive thud rattled the room as if the whole building was shaking. The recoil sent Hoshino tumbling backwards. He lay there, sprawled face up on the tatami, gasping for air, his head filled with soft mud whirling round and round.
I don't think, he thought, I'll ever lift something this heavy again as long as I live.
Later on, though, it turned out that this prediction was overly optimistic.
Mr. Hoshino?
Well, what?
The entrance opened, thanks to you.
You know something, Gramps? I mean, Mr. Nakata?
What is it?
Face up, eyes still shut, Hoshino took another long, deep breath and exhaled.
It better have opened up.
Otherwise I killed myself for nothing.
33. I get the library ready to open before Oshima arrives. Hoover all the floors. Wipe the windows. Clean the toilet. Wipe down all the chairs and desks. Spray the banister. Polish it to a nice shine. Dust the stained glass on the landing. Sweep the garden. Switch on the air conditioning in the reading room and the storeroom's dehumidifier. Make coffee. Sharpen pencils. A deserted library in the morning. There's something about it that really gets to me. All possible words and ideas are there, resting peacefully. I want to do what I can to preserve this place, keep it neat and tidy. Sometimes I come to a halt and gaze at all the silent books on the stacks, reach out and touch the spines of a few. At 10:30, as always, the Mazda Miata roars into the car park, and Oshima appears, looking a little sleepy. We chat for a while, until it's time to open. If it's okay, I'd like to go out for a while, I tell him once we're open. Where to? I need to go to the gym and work out. I haven't taken any exercise for a while. That wasn't the only reason. Miss Sayaki comes into work late in the morning, and I don't want to bump into her. I need some time to get my thoughts together before I see her again. Oshima looks at me and, after a pause, nods. Watch out, though. I don't want to henpeck you, but you can't be too careful, okay? Don't worry, I'll be careful, I assure him. Backpack slung from one shoulder, I board the train. At Takamatsu Station, I catch a bus to the fitness club. I change into my gym clothes in the locker room, then do some circuit training, plugged into my Walkman, Prince blasting away. It's been a while, and my muscles complain, but I manage. It's the body's normal reaction. Muscles screaming out, resisting the extra burden put on them. Listening to Little Red Corvette, I try to soothe that reaction, suppress it. I take a deep breath, hold it, exhale. Inhale, hold, exhale. Even breathing, over and over. One by one, I push my muscles to the limit. I'm sweating like crazy, my shirt soaked and heavy. I have to go over to the cooler a few times to gulp down water. I go through the machines in the usual order, my mind filled with Miss Saiki, about the sex we had. I try to clear my head, blank everything out, but it's not easy. I focus on my muscles, absorb myself in the routine. The same machines as always, same weights, same number of reps. Prince is singing Sexy Motherfucker now. The end of my penis is still a bit sore and stings a little when I take a pee. The tip's red. My fresh-from-the-foreskin cock is still young and tender. Condensed sexual fantasies. Prince's slippery voice. Quotes from all kinds of books. The whole confused mess swirls in my brain, and my head feels as if it's about to burst. I have a shower, change into fresh underwear, and catch the bus back to the station. Hungry, I duck into a cafe near the station and have a quick meal. As I'm eating, I realize this is where I ate on my first day in Takamatsu, which starts me wondering how many days I've been here. It's been a week or so since I started staying at the library, so I must have got to Shikoku about 3 weeks ago. I have some tea after I'm finished eating, and watch the people bustling to and fro in front of the station. They're all going somewhere. If I wanted to, I could join them. Take a train to some other place. Throw away everything here. Go to somewhere I've never been. Start from scratch. Like turning a page in a notebook. I could go to Hiroshima, Fukuoka, wherever. Nothing's keeping me here. I'm 100% free. Everything I need to get by for a while is in my backpack. Clothes, wash bag, sleeping bag. I've hardly touched the money I took from my father's study. but I know I can't go anywhere. But you can't go anywhere. You know that very well, the boy named Crow says. You held Miss Saiki, came inside her so many times, and she took it all. Your penis is still stinging, still remembering how it felt to be inside her. One of the places that's just for you. You think of the library, the tranquil, silent books lining the stacks. You think of Oshima, your room, Kafka on the shore hanging on the wall, the 15-year-old girl gazing at the painting. You shake your head. There's no way you can leave here. You aren't free. But is that what you really want? To be free? In the station, I pass by policemen making their rounds, but they don't pay me any attention. Seems like every other person I pass is some tanned kid my age, shouldering a backpack. And I'm just one of them, melting into the scenery. No need to get jumpy. Just act natural, and nobody will notice me. I jump on to the little two-car train and return to the library. Hey, you're back, Oshima says. He looks at my backpack, dumbfounded. My word. Do you always lug around so much luggage with you? You're a regular Linus. I boil some water and have a cup of tea. Oshima's twirling his usual long, freshly sharpened pencil. Where his pencils finish up when they get too short, I have no idea. That backpack's like your symbol of freedom, he says. Guess so, I say. Having an object that symbolizes freedom might make a person happier than actually getting the freedom it represents. Sometimes, I say. Sometimes, he repeats. You know, if they had a contest for the world's shortest replies, you'd win it hands down. Perhaps. Perhaps, Oshima says, as if fed up. Perhaps most people in the world aren't trying to be free, Kafka. They just think they are. It's all an illusion. If they really were set free, most people would be in a real pickle. You'd better remember that. People actually prefer not being free. Including you. Yeah. I prefer being unfree too. Up to a point. Jean-Jacques Rousseau defined civilization as when people build fences. A very perceptive observation. And it's true. All civilization is the product of a fenced-in lack of freedom. The Australian Aborigines are the exception, though. They managed to maintain a fenceless civilization until the 17th century. They were dyed in the wool free. They could go where they wanted, when they wanted, doing what they wanted. Their lives were a literal journey. Walkabout is a perfect metaphor for their lives. When the British came and built fences to pen in their cattle, the Aborigines couldn't fathom it. And, ignorant to the end of the principle at work, they were classified as dangerous and antisocial and were driven away to the outback. So I want you to be careful. The people who build high, strong fences are the ones who survive the best. You deny that reality only at the risk of being driven into the wilderness yourself. I go to my room and put down my backpack. Next I head to the kitchen, brew some coffee and take it to Miss Saiki. Metal tray in both hands, I walk carefully up each step, the old floorboards creaking. On the landing, I step through a rainbow of brilliant colours from the stained glass. Miss Saiki's sitting at her desk, writing. I put down the coffee cup, and she looks up and asks me to sit in my usual chair. Today she has on a café au lait coloured shirt, over a black T-shirt. Her hair's pinned back, and she's wearing a pair of small pearl earrings. She doesn't say anything for a while. She's looking over what she's just written. Nothing in her expression is out of the ordinary. She screws on the cap of her fountain pen and lays it on her writing paper. She spreads her fingers, checking for ink stains. Sunday afternoon sunlight is shining through the window. Somebody's outside in the garden talking. Mr. Oshima told me that you went to the gym, she says, studying my face. That's right, I say. What kind of exercises do you do there? I use the machines and free weights, I reply. Anything else? I shake my head. Bit of a lonely type of sport, isn't it? I nod. I imagine you want to become stronger. You have to be strong to survive, especially in my case. Because you're all alone. Nobody's going to help me. At least no one has until now. So I have to make it on my own. I have to get stronger, like a stray crow. That's why I gave myself the name Kafka. That's what Kafka means in Czech, you know. Crow. Hmm, she says, mildly impressed. So you're Crow. That's right, I say. That's right, the boy named Crow says. There must be a limit to that kind of lifestyle, though, she says. You can't use that strength as a protective wall around you. There's always going to be something stronger that can overcome your fortress, at least in theory. Strength itself becomes your morality. Miss Saiki smiles. You catch on quickly. The strength I'm looking for isn't the kind where you win or lose. I'm not after a wall that'll repel power coming from outside. What I want is the kind of strength to be able to absorb that outside power, to stand up to it. The strength to quietly endure things, unfairness, misfortune, sadness, mistakes, misunderstandings. That's got to be the most difficult strength of all to make your own. I know. Her smile deepens one degree. You seem to know everything. I shake my head. That's not true. I'm only 15, and there are plenty of things I don't know. I should know them, but I don't. I don't know anything about you, for one thing. She picks up the coffee cup and takes a sip. There's nothing that you have to know, nothing inside me you need to know. Do you remember my theory? Of course, she says, but that's your theory, not mine. So I have no responsibility for it, right? Exactly. The person who proposes the theory is the one who has to prove it, I say. Which leads me to a question. About? You told me you'd published a book about people who'd been struck by lightning. That's right. Is it still available? She shakes her head. They didn't print that many copies to begin with. It went out of print a long time ago, and I imagine any leftover copies were destroyed. I don't even have a copy myself. As I said before, nobody was interested. Why were you interested in that subject? I'm not sure. I guess there was something symbolic about it. Or maybe I just wanted to keep myself busy, so I set a goal that kept me running around and my mind occupied. I can't recall now what the original motivation was. I came up with the idea and just started researching it. I was a writer then, with no money worries and plenty of free time, so I could more or less take on whatever sparked my interest. Once I got into it, though, the subject itself was fascinating. Meeting all kinds of people, hearing all kinds of stories. If it wasn't for that project, I probably would have withdrawn even further from reality and ended up completely isolated. When my father was young, he worked as a caddy on a golf course and was hit by lightning. He was lucky to survive. The man he was with died. A lot of people are killed by lightning on golf courses, big, wide-open spaces, with almost nowhere to take shelter. And lightning loves golf clubs. Was your father also named Tamura? Yes, and I think he was about your age. She shakes her head. I don't remember anybody named Tamura. I didn't interview anybody by that name. I don't say anything. That's part of your theory, isn't it? That your father and I met while I was researching the book, and as a result you were born. Yes. Well, that puts an end to it, doesn't it? That never happened. Your theory doesn't stand up. Not necessarily, I say. What do you mean? Because I don't believe everything you're telling me. Why not? Well, you immediately said you'd never...